Good afternoon and welcome to another presentation of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, now in its 22nd year. Each month we bring an expert on some aspect of foreign policy to address our membership and our public radio audience. My name is Jan Rosenbaum. I'm a board member of the Forum. Today we're coming to you from the Somerset Resort in Rockport, Maine. Today's speaker is Julia Swag, and her topic will be Cuba and the changes it has undergone since Fidel Castro gave up power. For more information about the forum and upcoming speakers, please go to our website, midcoastforum.org. We now join the meeting in progress with our president, Mac DeFord, introducing today's speaker.
Today, we're going to talk about Cuba, and our speaker is Julia Swag. She's an American author and scholar of Latin American studies. She's the Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin American Studies and Director for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's on the editorial board of Foreign Affairs in Espanol, has written several books. Her most recent book, mostly about Cuba, Inside the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro and the Urban Underground, U.S.-Cuban Relations in the 21st Century. And her most recent book, which just came out last year and is available outside to buy, it was extremely well reviewed, Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know. So we're going to find out a lot what everybody needs to know, but if you really want to get the answer, I suggest you buy the book. Julia, come on up.
Thank you all so much for coming, and Mac and Jim and the rest of you for gathering so many of you on a beautiful Memorial Day holiday. I still am stunned that you would select indoors for outdoors on such a beautiful day. I'm here today with my wonderful husband, Reed Thompson, who we grabbed this opportunity to come up and leave our kids with their aunt and spend the weekend up here in your neck of the woods, and we've had a great time together. The first thing I'd like to know, what I would like to know, is why I didn't get such a spicy title for my talk. It just says Cuba. Cuba, not how screwed are we, nothing so delectable, but I hope I can add some color to that four-letter word, my favorite four-letter word that I can't seem to get away from, and I'm curious, and I hope you'll share with me in the Q&A what it is that drew you to this topic. I have some suspicions, but I'd like to hear about that a little bit. I'm going to speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have a bit of a discussion, I hope. And I'm going to do something which is a little bit uncomfortable, which is, I'm a historian by training, although I work as a policy analyst at the Council on Foreign Relations, and what I'm going to do today is put aside my interest in the sort of deeper history of Cuba and U.S.-Cuban relations. If I were to do that, I would go back to the end of the 19th century and talk about the wars of independence that were fought in Cuba and talk about the roots of Cuban nationalism to set the predicate for a discussion. But I'm going to jump ahead and talk about the very recent past, which doesn't really qualify as history, but it's certainly one of the reasons why I was motivated to write the book that that Mac mentioned, as well as my other book on Cuba. We're now in the 50th year of the Cuban Revolution, and I first went to Cuba 25 years ago, which is sort of stunning, because if you had said to me, do you think 25 years ahead you'll still be thinking about and ruminating about this topic, I certainly would have said no. But in the intervening period of time, I've had some interesting experiences that have led me to stick to this subject, and having worked on a lot of other issues in Latin America, have recently come back somewhat to the topic of Cuba, given the recent events that were really kicked off in July of 2006, when Fidel Castro's staff secretary announced that he would be handing provisional power over to his brother Raul and to half a dozen of his closest comrades, some of whom he had fought in the mountains with in the 1950s, and some of whom he had trained subsequently in his inner circle. So to try to understand what has happened in the last few years and why what we have seen is a very stable succession, I have traveled back to Cuba a great deal since that period, since the summer of 2006, to take the pulse and have a sense of what's unfolding there. So what I'm going to do is talk about three different sort of geographic locations where this drama of Cuba and its future and its history and its relationship with the United States play out. I'll talk about what's unfolding on the island under Raul Castro's presidency, now over 2 years old. I'll talk a bit about Miami and the development demographic and political and cultural there. And of course, I'll talk about Washington, the legacy that Barack Obama inherited in terms of U.S. policy and the beginnings, steps that the Obama administration has taken, and then I'll talk a little bit about what might be coming down the pike going forward. Very, very briefly, Reed and I were in Cuba in the middle of the 1990s, when I was doing my research for what was my first book, Inside the Cuban Revolution, and that was a period when we lived with a family and observed close up how a family lives, also observed close up the political retaliation that takes place against some artists, intellectuals, and writers when they step into the cauldron of U.S.-Cuban relationship in ways that the regime can't deal with. I've also taken human rights monitors into Cuba's prisons and seen prison conditions, interviewed political prisoners and common criminals, and worked sort of in the sort of 30,000 feet stratosphere of U.S. policy toward Cuba. So jumping ahead, that was just a bit about my background. That summer of 2006, Fidel's illness is announced. We later learned that it was a severe case of diverticulitis, and over the course of the remaining months of 2006, Fidel Castro nearly died and a couple of times. The remarkable story we can talk about later is what it's like for a man of his age, then 80, to come that close to the end and then revive and survive quite well. The period between 2006 and 2008 was a time when Raul Castro was putting together building the consensus among the military, among the party, and among the nomenclature of the country to begin to make some changes on the island. It took place in a period of relatively strong economic indicators that Cuba was experiencing, growth, income from nickel, from tourism, from remittances, a diversified trade and investment portfolio, and a constant flow of financial and political and ideological support from Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. In this interim period, Raul Castro took a fairly overt pulse-taking of the country and gave Cubans the space to publicly lay out their view of the problems that Cuba faces and how Cubans might address those problems, so that when he delivered his inaugural address in 2008, expectations among the Cuban population were very, very high for some substantial change, especially in the sort of economic and material dimensions of their lives. And expectations were also high and poised for change among the political elite and policy leadership of the country. In that inaugural address, which I always go back to when I come and speak to groups like yours, there was a couple of things that were refreshing. The first part of the address, notably, was its length, only 34 minutes. And 34 minutes, as all of you know, you laughed, is maybe about an eighth of the time of an average speech by Fidel Castro. In that speech, though, the substance was also important. He laid out a reform agenda. He didn't call it that, but he laid out an agenda for what he described as modest and moderately paced measures to improve the spiritual and material lives of the Cuban people. And that little phrase, the spiritual and material lives of the Cuban people, really set it all, because what Cubans had been dealing with, especially since the collapse of the Soviet bloc, was almost 20 years of extreme deprivation. Extreme deprivation by comparison to the relative sort of fat and happy era of Comic-Con, in which the subsidy from the Soviet Union really did deliver some more than just a basic material level of well-being, but more than that. So this prospect for improvement had to do with some things that were and still are more symbolic than not, such as the ability to buy cell phones, to go and spend money and take advantage of the network of hotels reserved previously just for tourists, but also more structural changes, such as the shrinking of the Cuban state bureaucracy. We've seen already now the elimination of several ministries, the consolidation of others, and the replacement of about two-thirds or more of the cabinet of Fidel Castro's cabinet of ministers that was in place in the time. In addition, a major agrarian reform was announced and has been implemented. Cuba imports 70% to 80% of the food that it consumes, and if any of you, and some of you I know, have traveled around the country, you see vast, undeveloped, uncultivated swaths of gorgeous land of potential great yields of a variety of crops, not just crops, but animals as well. So the agrarian reform that has begun did begin to take off, but it has its problems. In addition, Raul talked about unifying the dual currency system, which is the cause of the perception by most Cubans of incredible inequality, the cause of that perception, and also one dimension of the real cause of inequality that has grown in the last 20 years. And a number of other measures, including he dangled out the right of Cubans to be able to travel freely on and off the island without requesting permission of their government, and he talked without using the word about privatizations, liberalizing the economy, sounding often in his emphasis on productivity and efficiency more like Margaret Thatcher than Karl Marx. He talked about the unfairness of a socialist system in which some people live on the dole and others work hard, and those living on the dole and working not at all benefit almost as much as the hardworking few. So he really did put on the table the kind of fundamental critique within the framework of what do we have to do to make our socialism better, not what do we have to do to become a liberal democracy like the Dominican Republic, but what do we have to do to sort of preserve the legacy of the first 50 years and build stakeholders among a youthful population, that doesn't have the kind of vim and verve for the revolution that the founding and mothers and fathers who are now retired have. So he raised expectations. Another element of expectations raised among the Cuban population was our electoral moment in 2008, the same time that he was putting together a cabinet and beginning to implement a series of measures designed to reform Cuba. We had a presidential election, and Barack Obama's election itself was, as it was across the globe, as you know, of incredible excitement on the ground in Cuba. Cuba is a population, I don't know the exact numbers, but an Afro-Cuban population that's very significant, and the election of an African-American in the United States was dazzling in Cuba as it was elsewhere and as it has been at home. But also, quite specifically, Obama campaigned on the premise that it would be a rational way to affect our national interests to reach out and negotiate with our adversaries, number one. And number two, specifically with respect to Cuba, he made a campaign speech in the heart and soul of Cuban American Miami, the Cuban American National Foundation, calling for measures to allow Cuban Americans to travel freely, to send remittances, and hinted at reopening the kind of people-to-people contact that the Clinton administration had, measures that the Clinton administration had put into place 10 years earlier. So expectations because of our own campaign and transition were raised in Cuba as well. In Miami, still I'm not going much beyond 2008 yet. So let me just stick to go through Miami. What we have seen in the Cuban-American public opinion and demographic overall in South Florida, we can speak about Cuban-Americans in New Jersey for their campaign finance relevance, but for the campaign finance but also electoral relevance, the key spot is South Florida. And in South Florida, what we've had over the last 10 years is a steady increase in the percentages of the Cuban-Americans who say that they support significant change in American policy toward Cuba, and who also readily embrace the humanitarian and sheer family rationale of having contact with their family members on the island. We also have a generational transition, as we do in Cuba, also taking place in Miami. And this has all created and contributed to a political change, which isn't seen so much in the representation that Cuban Americans have in Congress, but it certainly is in terms of the policies that Cuban Americans pull that they support, and in terms of their actions and behavior. And I would go back to a very important turning point in Cuban American opinion, which had to do with the Elian Gonzalez story. If you remember that story, I won't go into it, but the Cuban American traditional exile leadership grabbed media attention very strongly around the Elian Gonzalez event to try to highlight the travesty in their view of sending him back to his father, to the gulag, as they described Cuba, and completely overplayed their hand and created, as a result of the political backlash against the way traditional Cuban-American exiles handled that story, the dissipation and the dissolution of the traditional Cuban-American block and voice and dominance, which has Cuban-Americans associated only with embargo, only with sanction, only with no talks whatsoever. Those days are over. And so what you have now are Republican business people in Cuban-Americans supporting a change toward in Florida, supporting significant changes towards Cuba. You have young people, the second and third generations, for whom Cuba is not a big deal issue, but who would readily support modest or more significant can change towards Cuba, and you really only have the kind of cornerstone that dominate Cuban-American radio and television still holding out for the traditional policy of embargo and sanction. Right now, I would say Miami, in terms of public opinion, is farther ahead than Washington in terms of what Miami would support versus what Washington is doing on the policy front. Looking for some water. Let me get up to Washington and thank you very much. Speak a bit about, thank you. Again, the period of time between the end of the campaign and Obama taking office. And let me say before I get into what has happened since 2008 that it won't fit under the... let me say a little bit about the decade or so, roughly, or from 2000 to 2010 or 1998 to 2008, in terms of what the Obama administration inherited vis-a-vis policy toward Cuba. The very end of the 1990s, the Clinton administration, I mentioned Elian, but there was other important developments in that period. Despite the symbol and substance of the effect of the Cuban government shooting down two planes in 1996 that had been flying and dropping leaflets over Havana and in Cuban territorial waters, the administration helped mightily by the visit of Pope John Paul to Havana in January of 1998, was able to put together an approach to the Cuba which didn't focus on lifting the embargo, but focused on ways to connect the two societies. And what we had, and the Cuban government participated, not just acquiescing, but actively participated in making this happen, was by 2001, we had 400,000 Americans who had traveled to Cuba. Some of them were Cuban Americans. Most went under license, not for tourism, but under license with their synagogues, their churches, their universities, their National Geographic local outlet. There was a kind of civil society flowering of contact between the two countries, facilitated by the two governments. At the same time, the beginnings of cooperation bilaterally between the two governments in counter-narcotics and immigration and other sort of neighborhood security issues had begun. It wasn't an easy process or period, but it was a period in which both governments benefited from the opening because it allowed them to gather intelligence about one another, and it allowed each to sort of refresh the Rolodex that each had on the other in terms of their society and the who's who. This was under Fidel Castro, a very different period than we're in right now. But when George Bush came into office, you know, he did have a political debt to Cuban Americans, number one, but he also had an ideological common cause with the notion that you don't reward a regime that represses human rights and keeps dissidents in jail and has the kind of closed political space that the Fidel Castro regime was clearly intent on maintaining. So, again, you know, and also this notion that you could use American power to bring democracy to halfway around the world, Iraq. Well, that was sort of doubly the case internally within the administration that 90 miles away, this surely ought to be possible. So there was an ideological common cause, and there was also a political debt to pay. So the George Bush, W. Bush administration eliminated almost all of the people-to-people contacts that the two countries had and cut off the bilateral contacts between the two governments on immigration and counter-narcotics, cut off most of the Cuban-American family travel that was allowed, almost all of the remittances that were allowed to go by 2003, 2004, and by the time we got to sort of 2003, 2004, really the sort of layers of communication and contact that had begun to build up in the 1990s had really frozen in place. In that, just 2 weeks before Fidel announced his stepping aside because of his illness, the administration released the second of a multi-volume study on how Washington would coordinate or help coordinate a transition in Cuba. And it reads as pure fantasy. It talks about sort of revamping all of Cuba's institutions and bureaucracy. It has a tone and an intent of debathification where the United States would accept nothing short in terms of change in Cuba, of sort of purging Fidelistas and communists from the military, from the major state institutions. And it was very explicit about the need for U.S. policy to interrupt any succession strategy that the Castro brothers would have put in place. That came out 2 weeks before Fidel's handed over provisional power to his brother, and it was dramatically disconnected from what actually transpired in the subsequent 2 years, up until 2008, and then in the 2 years since Raul Castro took office. So that by way of legacy and background, Obama comes into office certainly not with any intention of a major overhaul toward Cuba, but yes, with our clear vision for overhauling America's standing globally. This is an administration that has a decent respect for the views of others. And with respect to Latin America, right out of the box, within a couple of months of the taking office, had to go to Trinidad Tobago for the Summit of the Americas, in which all of the heads of state but from the Americas but Raul Castro were to attend. And President Lula of Brazil, but also President Uribe of Colombia, and everybody in between in terms of the ideological diversity that we now have in the region, had made it clear that, but especially Lula, and also Lula to Bush before him, that America's policy toward Cuba would be seen in Latin America as a barometer of the extent to which Washington was ready to work in partnership, take Latin America's definition of its own interests seriously, and Washington was put on notice that Cuba was the threshold. And what was meant quite explicitly was change your policy toward Cuba. So if you remember, maybe you don't, Obama went to Trinidad Tobago, and both Hillary and President Obama said lots of really good-sounding things like U.S. policy toward Cuba has failed, or good to me, sounding good to me, maybe. It's time to write a new chapter in U.S.-Cuban relations. I don't know if they meant it or not, but they certainly said the words, and to make manifest their intent, announced a couple of measures leaning in the direction of change, eliminating all restrictions on Cuban Americans from traveling to Cuba, eliminating restrictions on their ability to send remittances to Cuba, hinting potentially at more to come. Privately, they had told many members of Congress that they were prepared to go back to the Clinton era of that broad people-to-people non-tourist travel. Didn't do it. They also announced a potential opening for American telecom companies to be able to do deals, to provide cell phone service in and between the United States and Cuba. And they announced the beginning of revitalizing the bilateral talks between the governments on neighborhood security and immigration issues. That was 2 years ago. Yes, no, I'm sorry. No, only 1 year ago, a little bit more than 1 year ago. And really there it stopped, and their steps were, really fell flat in Trinidad and Tobago. Latin America, it's important to note that in the year 2009, when expectations were raised for an overhaul of U.S. policy generally in Latin America, we got stuck with a coup in Honduras and then some other miscommunications and mishandling of an announcement of a base agreement in Colombia that all told really turned opinion sort of back from sort of breathless expectation about Obama to kind of benign disappointment. Some would say not so benign. But Cuba and the administration's disposition to do anything further on Cuba, also a casualty not only of broader disinterest in Latin America, but of the fact that the United States has much more significant priorities than Latin America and than Cuba. Are we screwed in Iraq and Afghanistan? I would say Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, major priorities internationally. And domestically, of course, we have the global financial crisis and its impact. We have the fraying of our own social contract. We have a major environmental crisis. That is, the list goes on and on. So if you're the president of the United States, if your perception is that the politics of the issue, the domestic politics of the issue, haven't changed dramatically, why spend political capital to overhaul Cuba policy when, and now I'm going to go back to Havana and talk a little bit about what's happening in Cuba, when you have a government under Raul Castro, which, as far as Washington seems to perceive things, really hasn't walked through the door that President Obama has opened for it. Now, I framed what I just said in that way because the when the administration made its announcement of Cuban-American travel and family measures, it said, we're not going to do more until we see concessions and changes and gestures from Havana. And that framing is exactly the wrong way to deal with Cuba. This is not a regime that is dying and at the edge of its seat waiting for Washington to hand it a package of goodies that it will then respond to by bringing Jimmy Carter down to oversee an OAS multi-party election or having the IMF come in and do a major restructuring package. This is 50 years and they're still playing with the deck of cards that we have dealt them for the last 50 years. So the expectation that allowing Cuban-American family members to travel there would then produce in Raul Castro a kind of, you know, radical overhaul of how he sees the world and what he sees for Cuba and its best interests was, I think, incorrect. And so what we've seen in Cuba is a very, very slow implementation of that reform agenda, not because of Washington, but because of for real issues that have affected Cuba in the last 2 years. First of all, the middle of 2008, and I know that I'm creeping in on the end of my time, so I'm going to wrap up soon. The heightened expectations were raised, but then three things happened in the second half of 2008. Number one, the global food and fuel crisis really hurt Cuba's pocketbook. Number two, Cuba was hit by three hurricanes in succession within 2 weeks that took out 20% of the country's GDP. And number three, the global financial crisis. These three, but especially the last two, have left Cuba I don't know if insolvency is the right word, because nobody has a real look at Cuba's books, but the ability to finance the changes that Cuba wanted to make that Raul Castro articulated has drastically declined. The price of Cuba's most lucrative commodity, nickel, has declined dramatically. Tourist dollars have gone down. Remittances have gone down. All of this is starting to pick up a little bit, but the impact in 2009 and 2010 was severe. Cuba stopped paying its creditors, froze dollar holding and euro accounts inside of its banking system for those international companies doing business there. Were not able to get access to their funds, stopped doing all but the most necessary of businesses, more cutbacks, and cutbacks which actually, in a certain sense politically, I think have helped Raul Castro make his case to a population that is one of the most spoiled populations in Latin America, if not the world, a population that's used to getting everything for free still. And he has been able to use this political crisis, this financial crisis, excuse me, to say, look, here's the long list of freebies that everyone gets. This is unsustainable. And to gradually make the case that working hard and making a profit and actually perhaps even owning private property and having private enterprise isn't necessarily a contradiction with socialist values. And that's where he's at today. So we've seen a slow rollout of sometimes experimentation in different parts of the country. You have in Santiago de Cuba right now, for example, open markets run by essentially profit-making enterprises, small businesses doing business in the peso, not their unusual currency called the CUC. You have the privatization, again, not using that word, of all hair salons and barbershops in the country. You also have the transportation system, which had lagged behind the agrarian reform, now beginning to it's beginning to be kosher to run privately. So private truckers are now able to get the food from market and bring it, I mean, from producers and bring it to market without giving the state the big cut that it used to take. Now, none of this is being announced as kind of, capitalism comes to Cuba or here's the major overhaul. A journalist that I know down there recently said to me, this revolution will not be televised. It's a really good point. Raul Castro, has a very fine line to walk through. How do you change without changing too rapidly and preserve the basic legacy of what Cubans expect and what it is that we brought this revolution around in order to create? And I'll stop with this. What is it that the founding mothers and fathers, who are now in their 70s and 80s, some of whom have now been brought back to run big ministries and major areas of Cuba's foreign and trade and investment portfolio, for example, what is it that they want, and what is it that the Cuban population, 60% of which is under 60 years old, want, and what's the play? It's basically this, two things. One, that the state is going to provide the basics of social services, sort of make sure that no one really falls through the crack. So that means pensions, health, education. It doesn't even necessarily mean housing anymore, and it doesn't even necessarily mean food. They're in the process of eliminating or taking big chunks of what's been on the list of the ration card of what all Cubans get every month off. So the basics of a welfare state, let's say, number one, and number two, with respect to the outside world and the United States, a modicum of independence. A Cuban intelligence agency, intelligence agent once said to me that long term, what Cuba aspired vis-a-vis the United States to was ni muy cerca, ni muy lejos, not too far and not too close. And for a small island country with the history that Cuba has had dealing with outside powers, that recognition that, some capacity to have an independent foreign policy, some ties in terms of trade and investment and family and culture to the United States without being gobbled up by the giant monster, that even for José Martí 150 years ago and today for Raúl Castro and for most all Cubans that I've ever met over the last 25 years is the fundamental goal. And so why things move slowly is because trying to produce that kind of dynamism but preserve the old values cannot happen overnight. Washington can facilitate the process, but has other priorities. And so I think we will continue to see a slow unfolding on the island and a slow unfolding thawing bilaterally as well. Thanks so much.
Julia, that was great. I don't think we've had a talk about Cuba for many, many years, so that was a terrific introduction. Questions? All right, Pat, we'll start over there, and then we'll move to Hilly. Yeah, he's got a microphone.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you for a great talk. It was very well organized.
Thank you.
What can Cuba do about taking advantage of that land, you say, that is very fertile? Can they do on their own without help from the outside to get that agricultural production significantly increased if they have it sitting there?
Great question, and thank you. I think there's an ethos in Cuba that they can do a lot without help from the outside, but this is 2010, and they're starting to connect to the idea that they need to connect to the outside. And a great example of that is, actually, I didn't mention this, in the year 2000, the U.S. Congress passed legislation that allowed Cuba to buy American agricultural products. And the United States has become Cuba's fifth largest supplier of food products in that period of time. And when things were good, they were spending $700-800 million a year on American food stock, but that doesn't help them so much. I mean, they need everything in terms of infrastructure, in terms of equipment, in terms of seeds, in terms of you name it, Cuban, and they also need Cubans who want to go and farm the land. I mean, like the rest of Latin America, Cuba is essentially an urban population by and large, and so they have to be able to make it appealing. That means people have to be able to make money to go out and work the land. They also need a better way to get. They have very good rains generally, except for the eastern part of the country, but they need irrigation systems. They have an allergy to having too much foreign investment. They're starting to have some foreign, well, they have some, but not in land. It's a bit like Mexico. You can't go to Cuba and buy land. But the Brazilians, for example, are starting to invest in Cuba on the agricultural front. And I think it's going to just take time because one of the things about this founding generation is that I didn't mention that Raul purged a bunch of people that had been most tied to the international economy who were running foreign policy and investment policy. Those people are gone. And the older, elderly, I would say, people that are coming back to run some of these sectors don't see the need intellectually, analytically, for outsiders to come in. So I think it's a real question. Last point is, for institutions like the IDB and the IMF and the World Bank to come in and help Cuba, the United States has to sign off on that, and then we have, in almost every single case, and for that to happen, we need to eliminate Helms-Burton, which is the law that passed in the 1990s after the shootdown. So we need to do some things legislatively in order to open up that space.
Oh, okay, well, actually, the microphone's there.
Well, just to follow up on your last comment, I wanted to know what you think are the realistic next steps for the United States to take and what we can do to facilitate or to put pressure on in this direction.
Thank you. Since Helms-Burton was passed, the executive branch cannot lift the embargo with a stroke of the pen. And so we have to take a look at what's possible within that for the executive branch to do and then what the Congress has to do. And, you know, you use the word what's realistically possible. And that, I mean, I think I have to be really honest about it. Let me tell you where we are right now. It's actually not such a bad place. There's right now a decision being made by the chairman of the Trade Subcommittee of the House Ways and Means Committee about whether there will be a markup of a bill to lift the travel ban and do some fixes on the ag policy that we do have in place. There was just a couple of votes, as I understand it, so it would be useful if you could find out who the swing votes are that are preventing the chairman from the chairman of the subcommittee from calling for a markup in that committee. Nancy Pelosi's office is also extremely important because they're doing the vote count right now to see if in the House there's votes for a floor vote to lift the travel ban. And that's the two are related. She's not going to actually call for the floor vote until it's marked out of that committee. But that's happening in the next 2 weeks as soon as we come back from recess. The administration is waiting to see whether it can just have the Congress do these openings on lifting the travel ban. The theory about the travel ban being lifted as the first thing out of the gate rather than trying to have Helms-Burton repealed or something is that the political momentum that would come subsequent for more openings to having Americans being able to freely travel to Cuba would help itself make the case for more steps to eliminate the sanctions. The administration has really been, in my view, let entirely off the hook. They did these few initial steps last year and then have been waiting for Congress, but Congress has so much on its plate, which is why I wouldn't put all the eggs there and why I would focus on what can the administration do to move this along. So it needs to put back in place the measures that we had up until 2003, allowing non-tourist travel for Americans under license through various organizations that, for example, your own, could get a license and bring members to Cuba. That kind of thing could be done with a stroke of a pen, and as I understand it, the administration also, Hillary Clinton's office, has on her desk a memo laying this out for academic, cultural, and essentially, you know, civil society, civil society, non-tourist travel. People like that at the State Department and Jim Jones at the NSC need to hear from people outside of the country that aren't just in Miami that this is something that Americans care about and are interested in. It's very hard to get their attention away from Afghanistan and Iraq, but at all those lines. Last thing, we should take Cuba off the terrorist list. The State Department terrorist list has Cuba on it, and the rationale for it is over. It was put on the terrorist list because of its support for insurgency in Central America in 1982. And there's no rationale for it being there, but as long as Cuba is on the terrorist list, full commerce can't take place.
Before Steve speaks, I've got a follow-up question, and that is, Julia, you were saying, you know, during the body of your speech that you thought the Cuban Americans in Miami are now pretty supportive of moving actually faster than the administration is moving.
Right.
So under the circumstance, it would seem that it would be sort of a win-win for the administration to move ahead or for Congress to move ahead. Nobody's going to be against them. They're not going to lose any
Yeah, I don't know if I have a good answer to that because I don't understand that. I mean, I'd have to look at the midterms coming up and see whose seat is at risk. I mean, as I noted, there's a gap. The Cuban-American representation in Congress is far more conservative than their own Cuban-American base, but that's because they don't any longer have only Cuban-Americans in their constituencies. They have others that they respond to, and so the loudest voice is still their financial contributors and the sort of old-school voter, and that's what the White House seems to be looking at still.
Julia, I had a question. You mentioned just briefly at the beginning the relationship of Venezuela with Cuba. And Venezuela provides so much fuel to and oil to Cuba. If they stop that, it would impact their economy drastically. What is that? How do you see that situation? And Chavez has an election coming up in September. If he lost some control in Congress, in his parliament, how would that affect Cuba if the relationship between Venezuela and Cuba changed?
I think that the financial benefits that Cuba has garnered from Chavez over the last 7 or so years can't be underestimated. So that is an extremely important relationship, and it is, You know, it's not only the financial dimension of it. It's also that Chavez is out there taking the slings and arrows, picking fights with George Bush at the UN, sort of taking the political space internationally that Fidel used to occupy, which has allowed Cuba to sort of go about focusing on its own domestic issues and transition and not really have the kind of loud environmental chaos that Fidel used to look for, it seems, in terms of the bilateral relationship. But the financial piece of it is very important. You know, there's a lot of speculation about how long can Chavez continue, but the truth is that the way that he has consolidated power over various executive institutions, the way that he has run the show there, and the weakness of the opposition inside of Venezuela is such that I wouldn't count on Chavez expiring anytime soon. And therefore, I think the Cuban calculus is they will take advantage of him being there for as long as absolutely possible, but they also know that, you know, he doesn't have the... he doesn't have the conditions to be there forever as they did. And so they have to, and I think this is one reason they keep the door open with the United States, they have to have access to the U.S. market. They have to begin to make more natural the trade and commerce and investment relationship with the United States because it's simply just more stable than Chavez.
My question comes after really just not understanding one thing you mentioned, not political at all, by the way. Having spent many years flying there with friends, I didn't understand, what is a dual currency?
I'm going to try to give this a little bit of history. Cuba right now has this kooky, wacky currency system, which is they have something called the CUC. It's got a real name, and I can't remember what it is, but it's referred to in the vernacular as the kook. And it trades at 1-to-1 with the dollar. And then it has a peso, and a peso is play money. It doesn't have any international value whatsoever, but Cubans are paid in pesos. And when they want to go and buy something like a pair of tennis shoes that's been imported from another country, not on the ration card, but in a regular retail shop, they have to trade their pesos for kooks at 25-to-1. And there's also a big black market there. Now, it used to be the dollar. There used to be that the dollar was the hard currency of choice and of law in Cuba. But Cuba went off the dollar in terms of how it requires its those doing business there to relate, and you can go there and do business in euros or Canadian dollars, but you have to trade all of them for kooks, and then the bank makes a piece of that. So the dual currency is the peso and the kook. Okay.
Julia, thank you so much for this very informative presentation. A question about the internal dynamics at a time of transition. Raul seems in charge. You call it a stable transition, which it seems to be so far. But there have been removals, one might say purges. There are clearly factions to some extent. Is the military a significant faction and restive, although Raul did headed them up? Is that a power player if you look a little further down the line? And just on the edge of that, some stories keep circulating in this country about Cuban complicity in drug trafficking. What do you know about any of that, other than it's probably spun up by people who don't like the current regime?
Excellent question. Thank you. The military is an incredibly important constituency, and because Raul is of and comes from the military and built those institutions, that's one of his most important bases. And one of the things that's happened in rehabbing or refashioning the the ministries is he's brought a lot of people in from the military to run different ministries. They're serving as ministers, they're serving as vice ministers, they're running the businesses that some of the industry, for example, agriculture and tourism, tourism especially, some mining, a bit of telecom, that's been in the hands of the military for a while, not entirely, but in some significant ways. So the military, I think, is one effect of having that kind of participation is that the military at the moment does not represent any kind of source of instability on the island to Raul. Those are his people, and they're also, they have a very different culture of doing business and operating whatever they're responsible for operating. And by that I mean, when Fidel was running the show out of the palace, and Fidel had his Grupo de Fidel who really ran the country out of the palace, there was a minister at every ministry, but the ministers weren't as accountable as the intimates around Fidel who sort of had a parallel government and ran the show. That's over. That Grupo de Fidel no longer exists. So Raul and the purges were part of it, has put his own people in place, and many of them come from the military. And one of the things that the words that you hear all the time in Cuba is institutionality, that what Raul is doing is institutionalizing a way of governance and governing and government that previously, because of Fidel's personality and his grupo and his sort of parallel way of getting things done, just didn't exist. I have had recently an experience of talking to a friend who runs a research institute who said to me, in the realm of accountability that is now being imposed top to bottom, oh, God, we have to file a plan every month of what we're going to do. And I said, a plan every month? I have to file a weekly report every week. And he said, yeah, Julia, but before we only had to do it every 5 years. So it's a long way around the issue of sort of by bringing the military in, you're getting a group of people who is used to accountability and chain of command and following through and complying with what is expected of them. And that's how Raul operates. The meaning of having the military have that much power in terms of the future sort of democracy, small d, is a very open question, one that's being debated on the margins, and not only on the margins inside of Cuba right now. In terms of drug trafficking, the drug trafficking accusation has come about off and on, and there was this moment, if you sound like you follow this, about 20 years ago when there was some purges and some executions that resulted, that were described as of senior people in the military and in the intelligence community there for dabbling with the Colombian cartels. I think the strategic view in Cuba is that Cuba cannot afford to get involved with drug traffickers or drug trafficking because it would be far too destabilizing, and also the Cuban military and others there are themselves vulnerable to corruption, and inserting drug trafficking into the mix would be highly destabilizing to the regime. So my view is that, you know, if you look at the map and you see where Cuba is and it sits in the Caribbean Basin at the center of all of those flows north and south of drugs and guns and people, Cuba is a relatively inhospitable zone to the organized crime that is very, very active in that region, at the moment at least.
We've got each, yeah.
I was wondering about education and whether the educational system is also enjoying perhaps some refocusing or to prepare a workforce for the future, whatever that means. And as part of that, what about training within the educational process for technology and all that that implies?
You all have excellent questions. Cuba has too many people who have university degrees and no jobs to go into once completing those university degrees, and there's finally a sort of coming to Jesus process happening there over this. And so there's a refashioning now where vocational training is now being put back into place. It was sort of drawn down a little bit because Cubans took so much pride in being able to produce so many highly educated young people. But right now, in terms of the workforce needs, I mean, the technology is one issue, and I'll get to that in a second. But the other is, for example, tourism. Cuba is planning for the end of the American travel ban, but Cuba doesn't have the sort of skilled tile workers and plumbers and people that they need in order to build a 4 or 5-star hotel. They've got the 3-star or the 3.5-star covered, but for an American tourist, they need to be able to draw on their own population as a labor force for services, you know, of the kind I listed, and for direct contact with the visiting tourists. And they don't really have that. As you know, they have a lot of people that have left their the occupations for which they were trained, doctors, professors, engineers, and who are working in the tourism industry because they make more money. So they have that problem to address, but they don't have the workforce that they need for that piece of what's coming. On the technology front, about 5 years ago, maybe a few more, they started a university that's designed to train kids that can develop software and that can try to position Cuba farther up the value-added food chain on the you know, hardware and software track, and it has been very, very impenetrable. I've tried to go there and visit it myself. I can't get in. I know very few outsiders, even some like me that follow and travel there a lot, that can go there. I've heard that there are some really, really well-trained people, but certainly not enough. So the answer is, they know that they have this as a problem, and they don't have the resources yet. They also probably don't have the political consensus to really make a shift. But between health and education, the percentage that Cuba pay, I wish I had this number, they spend a huge percentage of their national budget on health and education. So once they make the decision, I'm sure the resources will go there.
Last question, I'm afraid.
Okay. Yes, Julia, thank you. That was a wonderful, in-depth talk, especially since you were taking after Raul, and it was only 34 minutes long. seriously, I was thinking about what you said earlier about his view of the socialist country mm-hmm. that he has in Cuba, and trying to bend and to be more flexible in marrying that with the privatization of agribusiness, small businesses, even perhaps some with some private profits. Has that been done in many other countries? I always think of socialism as being strict, black and white, and not really incorporating any other kind of government within it.
Well, you know, whatever model Cuba arrives at, let's say 10 to 20 years from now, we're going to be able to describe what is Cuba. It's in a changing mode right now. Cubans themselves may describe it as socialist, but it might be very much a hybrid of a sort of mixed economy where you have private economic activity, but you have a still significant role for the state. And that does exist in other parts of the world. I mean, I'm thinking of Vietnam, for example. China is too big and too powerful to be looked to by Cubans, but Vietnam is one place, although its population is 40 million and not 11 million. They can call it whatever they want to. I mean, it may at some point not be called socialism, but I think that the message Raul Castro has been saying, speaking and then beginning to deliver with deeds, is that we need to be a lot less orthodox about what's kosher here. I'm mixing metaphors probably, but but, you know, if socialism means, you know, protecting the weakest in our society and maintaining some independence for this national project to succeed after we're gone, then that kind of hybrid is going to be okay, and we can still call it socialism. Hell, we're Cubans, so we can call it what we want to. Okay.
That's great, Julia. That's a terrific way to end it. Thanks a lot. After such a great talk, this is something of an anticlimax, but...
Can we put some wine in it?
Absolutely. We'll do it right now. It's the... Julia could already see what it was. She's heard about it in advance, obviously. The famous Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations mug. And I tell you what, if you take it to Cuba next time you go down there and you give it to Raul Castro, we'll send you another one.
Okay. Thank you. That's a deal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is great. I love that.